Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the Texas killing fields. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, like and subscribe, leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon for as little as $1.99 a month. You can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just like show friends Channel and Anthony did, as well as the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Debbie, Samantha, Betty, and Matt. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Alright, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax, get yourself something to drink, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go in the crypt. We left off last time. We looked pretty extensively at the case of Renee Johnson and her friend Sharon Shaw, as well as the circumstances surrounding the man who was convicted of their murder, Michael Self, whom many believe is innocent of the crime. Now, after all of this, after the discoveries of these bodies and the charges being brought against various individuals during the spring and summer of 1972, it appears that no further activity in the cases known as the Texas killing fields took place for quite a while, over a year, in fact. Obviously, this led some in law enforcement to believe that the individuals who had been arrested for these various crimes, or at least tied to them when they were arrested for other crimes, may in fact have been responsible for the murders and disappearances that they had been plagued with during the 6-month window that it was most prevalent during 1971. However, this was going to change in January of 1973. And I want to make one thing clear. While there were other murders of young women in Houston, Galveston, and the surrounding environs, these cases that we are talking about are the ones that have mostly been found in and around the I-45 corridor in these various fields, bayous, and marshes. I believe as we continue on with these cases, you're going to see different modus operandi at play, which, at least to me, says that there were different individuals responsible for clusters of killings. On January 3rd, 1973, a 16-year-old by the name of Kimberly Ray Pitchford had just returned to her sophomore year of high school after the winter break. Now, Kimberly was said to be a fairly normal young girl. Her best of anyone's knowledge, she had no habits that may have endangered her. She worked part-time at a fast food restaurant, liked hanging out with her friends, that sort of thing, enjoyed going roller skating. Now on the 3rd, after school, she was set to have her first driving lesson. It was off campus. We know that she had a typical school day, had an attention after school, and that by 5 p.m. that afternoon, she was at the driving school with instructions to call her mother when she was finished. At 6 p.m., Kimberly, wearing a heavy black coat that she had received for Christmas, left the driver's ed building and was not seen again. Obviously, her parents are instantly concerned when they don't hear from their daughter. Unlike in some other cases where the police told the family that they needed to wait, you know, she'll probably show up back home. Because of the things that had happened 2 years prior, the police are immediately on alert and allow the Pitchfords to file a missing persons report. Now, on January 4th, two boys were on a wooden bridge on County Road 65, which is roughly 22 miles from the driving school that Kimberly had attended. As the boys later recounted to police, they saw something black lying against a fence in the distance, and while it somewhat piqued their interest, they let it be. The following day, the 5th, they were in this same area driving around when they again noticed this black object lying against the fence and decided to investigate it. Pulling to the side of the road, the boys got out and walked up to it, noticing almost at once that it appeared to be a black coat. As the boys later stated, as they were walking back to their car, one of them noticed something in a bayou that was butted up against the field that they were in. Now, when most people think of a bayou, they imagine, you know, a swamp, which is usually fed by a series of rivers or streams flowing into it. And one of these rivers or streams that was flowing into this bayou, the boys saw something pinned against the pylons of a bridge. According to the boys, it appeared to be a person that was caught in the rushing currents. This frightened them. They didn't know what to do, so they took off and went back home, where one of the boys informed his father of what they had seen, and then the trio returns to this river slash bayou, which is in Angleton, Texas, roughly 44 miles from downtown Houston, southward past Sugarland and League City. The father would later tell police that upon arriving, he saw what appeared to be a girl's body lying face down in the water, pressed against the supports of the bridge, not knowing whether or not this was in fact a real person or a mannequin. The man ends up getting a long branch and poking the body, at which point it occurs to him that this is almost certainly a real person. The trio then leaves the area and drives to a nearby home where they are allowed to use the telephone and they contact the police. Once on the scene, the police note that the body in the water is wearing a blue and red dress, a red bra, and a small gold cross on a chain around her neck. After the body is recovered and taken to the morgue, the police look through recent missing persons cases, which have gone out through the teletype from the surrounding towns and cities, and realize that this is in fact most likely Kimberly Pitchford. This was confirmed when the police investigate the black coat that the boys had discovered and find a learner's permit inside of one of the pockets made out to Kimberly Pitchford. Obviously, the family is devastated to learn that their daughter is deceased. The medical examiner is eventually going to rule Kimberly's death as ligature strangulation. Again, as with the other cases where bodies are discovered quickly, we have no information stating whether or not a sexual assault took place either prior to or after Kimberly was deceased. However, my personal opinion is, given the nature of these crimes and how many of the victims are found, it's almost a certainty that she was, in fact, assaulted in some manner. And as I stated last episode, should this be the case, it's very likely that either the police just have never given out this information, or that the medical examiner did not check to see if one had occurred, which I highly doubt. I think it's more likely that the police have withheld this information. Now, Kimberly's case goes cold pretty quickly. Law enforcement speaks with her parents, the people at the driving school, her friends, and unfortunately, Kimberly Pitchford's case goes cold almost as soon as it has begun. Obviously, people in the Houston-Galveston area recall what had happened in a few years prior, and they're bracing themselves for another disappearance, but to the best of our knowledge, none happened that match any of the particulars that have made these cases stand out. 19 months later, on September 6th, 1974. This time, the missing came from Dixon, Texas, which is along the I-45 corridor. Two teenage girls, 12-year-old Brooks Bracewell and 14-year-old Georgia Gear, failed to show up for school that day at McAdams Junior High School. Now, the school contacts the parents. Georgia's mother ends up contacting law enforcement and telling officers that she believes the girls have both skipped school that day. The police believe that the girls have run away, and instead of doing their due diligence, they only put out tentative feelers to see if they can maybe locate these girls. Stories start to come in stating that both girls had been seen near a hotel on County Road 517 near Alvin. According to these reports, the girls were seen playing football with a group of unidentified older men. Later, they were seen hitchhiking, while other witnesses placed the girls at a convenience store in Alvin itself. However, from that point on, the trail appears to go cold, and the police, in fact, do not search for these girls, instead listing them as runaways. And here's where things get a little bit wonky. On April 18th, 1976, a man working at one of the Phillips oil fields came across partial skeletal remains in a culvert ditch in Alvin, Texas. The police are contacted, and from everything that I can find, very little is done to investigate any of this. However, they do find some bits of fabric and more pieces of bone inside of this field. It doesn't appear that the police went to any real lengths to try and identify these remains. In fact, it would not be until 1980 when a new detective is given their case of Brooks and Georgia that the police began to suspect that foul play was at work in their disappearance. As the ditch where the remains had been discovered in 1976 was close to the location the girls were last thought to have been at, near a convenience store. Now, the remains are eventually identified as belonging to Brooks Bracewell. And as such, on April 3rd, police conduct another search of the area where Brooks's bones were found. And it's at this point that they find evidence that leads them to conclude that not only is this the final resting place of 12-year-old Brooks Bracewell, but also of Georgia Gear, going back to 1976, as which the disappearance of Kimberly Pitchford, the crimes seem to have stopped after the disappearances of Brooks and Georgia. However, this was only but a short reprieve, as on May 21st, 1977, at roughly 10:40 a.m., a 12-year-old by the name of Suzanne Susie Bowers left her grandmother's home in Galveston. Her grandmother lived not far from the Galveston seawall, and according to statements later given to police, Susie had been planning to walk roughly a mile to her home, at which point she was going to change to a bathing suit and then ride her bicycle to a beach which was located roughly 3 miles from her home along Seawall Boulevard. Now, her parents later said that Susie had been planning to meet a friend at the beach. They planned to spend the rest of the day enjoying the sun and fun. As with other victims, Susie was known to have been, you know, a water baby. She liked to surf and ski and swim, all of the things that you would expect a 12-year-old girl living not far from the beach to enjoy. Now, according to the friend that Susie had been planning to meet that day on Stewart Beach, Sarah Groves, she waited for Susie to arrive, and unfortunately, Susie never does. So Sarah Groves states that she wasn't initially worried. You know, things like this often happened. She figured maybe Susie had gotten in trouble for something and had been forbidden from going to the beach that day. However, when she arrives home later that afternoon, Susie's grandmother calls the Grove household asking if Susie is there, as she never arrived back at her house after leaving her grandmother's residence. Sarah Groves tells Susie's grandmother that Susie never arrived at the beach. However, she still, by her own admission, didn't think anything was the matter. It wasn't until later that evening at roughly 6 p.m. when Susie's grandmother continued to call that Sarah began to get a sinking feeling in her stomach that something was gravely amiss. Not long after this, Susie's parents contact the Galveston police and officially report their 12-year-old daughter as missing. Inexplicably, despite what has happened over the last 6 years, the Galveston Police Department decides to treat Susie's disappearance as a runaway. Of course, her family ends up protesting against this, pointing out to the Galveston Police Department that Susie wasn't the type to run away. Susie's stepmother told the Galveston County Daily News, quote, "All the money Suzanne said saved for a choir trip is still here, as are all her clothes. Her friends are all accounted for. She didn't run away. We just don't know what happened. It's as if she was swallowed up in thin air. We have no clues. She's just gone." As with the other cases that we have already covered in this episode, after Susie Bowers goes missing, there is very little activity in terms of identifying suspects or eyewitness statements. Susie Bowers simply disappeared. No one seems to have seen anything, and it's not very long before Susie's case goes cold, just as the other missing girls' disappearances and subsequent murders have. Now, the Bowers family keeps hope alive that Susie may be found. On March 25th, 1979, two boys were riding dirt bikes through a field in Alta Loma, Texas, which is located in the southwestern area of Galveston County and is now part of Santa Fe. According to the boys, as they were riding through this field, they saw a training bra lying in the weeds, and not long after that, they saw pieces of cloth, which were later described as red, blue, green, and brown. Not long after this, they came upon skeletal remains. Obviously, they flee the area and contact law enforcement, who arrive. The body is later determined to have belonged to 12-year-old Susie Bowers, and it's noted in the pathologist's report that there appears to be pellet wounds from a shotgun in Susie's skull. However, no cause of death is ever officially given. Now, a couple of things to point out here concerning Susie Bowers' death. Henry Lee Lucas is going to confess to having murdered her during his spree of serial confessions in the early 1980s, although, as with the majority of his confessions, Lucas is later going to recant this, saying that he had only done so after authorities had provided him with all of the details of the case, and that he had done this in exchange for perks while incarcerated, such as access to a television as well as cigarettes. Other things to think about are the fact that Susie was found not far from where Colette Wilson, the first girl officially listed as a victim in the Texas Killing Field murders, disappeared from in Alvin, Texas. Now, just like Susie, Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gere's skull were also discovered in the Alvin, Texas area, and that all four of these young girls, Colette Wilson, Brooks Bracewell, Georgia Gere, and Susie Bowers, all showed some type of trauma to their skulls. My personal belief is that Colette Wilson was not a victim of the individual or individuals who took Greer, Bracewell, or Bowers, and was in fact a victim of the individual who was operating in and around Galveston during 1971. The individual who took great pains to place his victims inside of water, the majority of whom were found with their skulls removed, their hands and feet bound together. One of Susie's friends could not allow this tragedy that had befallen her friend to go, and by her own account, did her own sort of investigation, and she learned after speaking to the property owner that around the time that Susie Bowers went missing, he saw two vehicles out on the property where this field is located that he owned. One of them was a pickup truck and the other was a van, although we have no further information regarding either of these vehicles, make or model, color, etc. Susie Bowers' disappearance and murder are the last known crimes to be linked to the so-called Texas Killing Field murders to have taken place during the 1970s. Now, I'm just going to throw out my opinion on this entire period of time. I think we're dealing with two separate killers in the series of crimes. I think the 1971 series of slayings were perpetrated by one individual. I believe that these murders that took place during the middle and latter part of the 1970s were the work of a different individual. And I'm basing this on the fact that the bodies were all found in fields, not in water, showed some form of head trauma, and that at least three of this second group of slayings were found near Alvin, Texas. I think that that is an important fact to consider. To me, that means that this individual is most likely familiar with the Alvin, Texas area, is comfortable with it, and more likely than not, sees that area as their own personal game preserve where they can store or get rid of the bodies of the young girls that they're slaying without too much fear of being discovered. I think that the individual who did the killings in the earlier part of the 1970s, in 1971, for them, there was a definite sexual motive involved in the slayings, and that the water and binding of the victims played a significant part in the fantasy that played out as they undertook each of the murders that they committed. People talk about these murders never really having been solved. I firmly believe that if police were able to find a suspect anywhere in the country that had a similar modus operandi to the 1971 killings, they very likely could have a good suspect, you know, and by similar MO, I mean similar in terms of victimology, in terms of how the victims were disposed of, i.e. in water, and how their remains were discovered. In this case, I'm speaking specifically of the fact that the heads of most of the victims were found detached from the bodies, and that the bodies had been bound by hand and foot. While I've never delved into this particular aspect of the crimes myself, I just have that gut feeling that this individual was arrested at some point after those 1971 killings and was convicted and sentenced to life in prison or the death sentence somewhere in the United States for either a single or a series of crimes that were very similar to those undertaken during 1971. We're going to be moving into the 1980s now, and it's this decade that really starts to get attention both nationally and internationally as the term the Texas Killing Fields is going to come into popular usage. And it's because there is a new series of disappearances and murders that are going to rock the Galveston area along the I-45 corridor. Before we go diving into the 1980s, I want to preface this next part of our coverage by saying that if you look online at the Texas Killing Fields, you're going to see a lot of crimes attributed to this series of murders. We're not going to be covering all of them, and it's not because I don't believe that these murders are important, only that not all of them are actually linked to the quote-unquote Texas Killing Fields. And I say that because it's my belief from looking at these cases over the years that there are series of murders that took place during various time spans which could be linked together for individual suspects, i.e. the 1971 murders. My belief is that was one individual. The middle part of the 1970s to the end is another murderer, and ones that took place during various points during the 1980 years are the actions of different murderers. One set that we're not going to be looking at was the disappearance and murder of the Klaus family. The reason for this is because the murders don't fit the parameters of the crimes that we are actually looking at, and it appears that their murders were not sexual in nature, but were instead a targeted killing conducted possibly by a cult. Another that we are not going to be looking at, which you will see listed on various lists of Texas Killing Field victims, is Michelle Angela Garvey. The reason for this being that Garvey, it appears, was kidnapped from her home in Connecticut and was found a month later dead in a field in Baytown, Texas. Again, just based on the parameters of the crimes that we are looking at, she does not fit those, and therefore, while still tragic, I am going to remove her from our coverage of the Texas Killing Fields. Although I may cover both of these cases as a supplemental to the main Texas Killing Fields series on the Patreon field in the coming weeks. I haven't decided on that as of yet. Now, the first case of the 1980s that we're going to be looking at was a cold case for almost 40 years, and that is the 1983 murder of a 20-year-old woman by the name of Susan Eads. Now, on August 30th of 1983, Susan Lee Eads left her home in Seabrook, Texas, which is in Harris County, at roughly 4:30 p.m. Now, there's conflicting accounts as to what Susan did for a living. Most have it that she was a cocktail waitress. However, according to KHOU Channel 11 out of Houston, Texas, Susan worked in numerous different restaurants as a waitress in Webster, Texas. She also took sporadic jobs working as a DJ in this same area. Now, what we know is that on the night that she went missing, Susan was at a place called Jason's Club. Now, witnesses later said that she was seen talking with a white male wearing a cowboy hat with a bushy mustache, but that when she left the club later that evening, Susan was alone. The following day, a passing motorist saw a body lying in the bushes along NASA Road 1. They immediately contacted police, who identified the body as belonging to Susan Eads. Susan was naked. She had bruises about her body. It was later determined that she had in fact been sexually assaulted before the bodysuit that she was wearing was used to strangle her to death. The car that Susan had been driving was located not far from where her remains were discovered, in a parking lot, and it was noted at the time that Susan's purse was missing. Now, police go about creating a sketch of the man last seen to have interacted with Susan at Jason's Club. However, they could not locate this man, and fairly quickly the case goes cold. That is, however, until Susan's mother starts getting a series of phone calls to her house. Obviously, Susan's mother contacts the Seabrook police, lets them know that somebody's been calling the house and harassing them, stating that the caller has said that they have pictures of her daughter, although they don't know that if they can show the pictures to her, and that, quote, some people have secrets they like to keep to themselves, unquote. Now, for some of these calls, the police were able to tap the line, and they captured the man who identified himself as Bill, stating that he lived in Houston on Telephone Road, However, the caller ends up hanging up very quickly on all of these calls before police are able to place a trace on it. Obviously, this infuriates both the police and Susan's family. However, by the time 1984 rolls around, the phone calls have stopped. Police have no evidence as to the veracity of the caller's claims or of the caller's identification. Years go by, and the police start looking into her case again, and they zero in on a serial killer by the name of Anthony Shore, who was known as the Tourniquet Killer, as he was known to have been active in the area during this point in time, and the manner of death matched his M.O. Police go so far as to have Shore's execution date postponed while they investigate, although it's later determined that he is not in any way, shape, or form involved in the murder of Susan Lee Eads. Then police get a break. They are able to test DNA that is discovered on the suit that was tied around Susan's neck. And after a lot of searching, which involves help of the FBI and online genealogy sites, they get a hit. The man's name is Arthur Ray Davis, and at the time of Susan's murder, he was a 35-year-old Vietnam veteran. He also worked as a boat captain. Now, amazingly, the pictures that they're able to get of Davis match the composite sketch of the man seen to have been talking to Susan on the night she disappeared exactly. I've never in my life seen a composite sketch that is so dead on for the individual as this composite sketch of Arthur Raymond Davis. That from the mustache, the high cheekbones, the hair hanging over his ears, the strong, pronounced chin, and the cowboy hat. Now, fortunately, Davis is never able to be tried for Susan's murder, as he dies somewhere between December of 1983 and January of 1984 in a car accident. Although police and the Eads family are certain that were he still alive, Davis would have been charged and convicted of Susan's murder. Now, the next victim is a 25-year-old woman by the name of Heidi Marie Villarreal Fye. And for me, she really is the first of this new batch of killings that's going to take place in and around Galveston, as she disappears from League City, Texas, which is a name that you're going to become quite familiar with as we move forward with these cases. As a number of victims end up disappearing from League City, but more importantly, she's also going to be last seen at a convenience store that a number of other young women and girls will be seen at. Now, Heidi Villarreal Fye worked as a cocktail waitress. She is last seen on October 10th, 1983 at this convenience store, which is located off of West Main Street and Hobbs in League City. On October 26th, 1983, a 16-year-old girl by the name of Sandra K. Ramber was in the kitchen at her family's home on Pine Street in Santa Fe. According to police reports, when Sandra's father returns later that afternoon, he finds his daughter missing and the front door to the house open. In addition, food was left in the oven, and Sandra's purse and coat are found still inside of the house. Her father initially believed that his daughter had gone to the store, However, by the next morning when Sandra has not returned home, he reaches out to the authorities, who tell him his daughter is most likely a runaway. Given the fact, however, that we are talking about her in this episode, it is almost a certainty that Sandra met a terrible fate, and there is a possibility that her remains may still be out there somewhere in the fields in and around Galveston, along the Route 45 corridor. The next case that we're going to be looking at is one of the more famous cases in the Texas Killing Fields saga, and that is the disappearance and murder of Laura Lynn Miller. Laura was the second child of Tim and Jan Miller. She was born in Ohio. She had a fairly difficult childhood, not in terms of her family life, but in terms of her personal life. We know that she suffered from a very devastating fever when she was a very little girl that left her in a coma for a few days, although she bounced back from this and ends up becoming a Star Trek runner. She was seen as the light in the center of the Miller family. Now, when Laura is 11 years old, she ends up having an extremely bad flu that leaves her with scars on her brain that end up giving Laura seizures for the unfortunately short remainder of her life. Not long after this period of time, the Millers end up moving to Texas, specifically the Houston-Galveston area, as the economy is booming during this period of time. Initially, the family settles in Dixon, where Tim starts working in construction, and he states that around this point in time, 1983-ish, he notices a change in his daughter, Laura. The hardworking young girl who had been a good student while they were in Ohio is starting to withdraw somewhat. Because of the seizures that she suffers, Laura is placed into special education classes, which her father states greatly embarrassed her. And it may be because of this that Laura starts hanging around with a different caliber of person than she previously had. Laura's family is somewhat distraught to find that their daughter is now smoking pot with these new friends of hers. This leads Tim and Jan to make a decision that they are going to move out of Dixon. During the summer of 1984, the Miller family purchases a one-story ranch house on Cardinal Drive in League City, roughly 10 to 15 minutes away from where the family had previously lived. According to Tim, the family was extremely hopeful for this new start, as while Laura could still see her friends from Dixon and her boyfriend, the school that she was going to was a better school, and hopefully his daughter would be around a better group of people. So the family purchases this home in the summer of 1984. They move in early September, and just a few days after moving in is when tragedy strikes. On September 10th of 1984, family is at home when Tim heads out to work. Now, this is in the morning. Her mother agrees to drive Laura to a nearby convenience store where Laura wants to call her boyfriend living back in Dixon, a young man by the name of Vernon. Now, by all accounts, Vernon was supposed to come to the Miller home later that afternoon or early evening. So Jan drives her daughter to a convenience store. the very same convenience store that Katie Marie Villarreal Fay had disappeared from just over a year prior. Jan says that she sat waiting for her daughter for a few moments and kept insisting that she needed to get to work, her daughter needed to get off the phone. After a few moments of this, however, Laura told her mom that she should just go on ahead and go to work, as they were only a mile from the house and she knew how to get back to the family home. Believing that her daughter was right, Jan Miller ends up driving to work, leaving her daughter talking on the phone at this convenience store with her boyfriend. Now, when her parents get home later that afternoon, Laura is nowhere to be found. And according to Tim Miller, at first they simply assumed that she was out somewhere with Vernon. However, a short time later, Vernon shows up at the Miller household looking for Laura. And it's then that the Millers feel the first pangs of worry. However, both parents later stated that they simply assumed their daughter had gone off with friends somewhere. However, as the evening wore on and Laura showed no signs of returning to the house, the Millers began driving the streets looking for their daughter. The following morning, Tim Miller is convinced that something is dreadfully wrong. Thinking that his daughter may have had a seizure, he contacts area hospitals describing his daughter as well as the condition from which she suffers, but unfortunately, Laura has not checked in at any of the hospitals, and it's at this point that Tim Miller contacts the League City Police Department. As with other cases that we've covered during this series, the League City Police Department basically brushes the Miller family off, telling them that it is very common for 16-year-old girls to run away. According to Tim Miller, by the morning of September 12th, he was absolutely certain that something had gone wrong with Laura, and he went to the police again. Quote, "I went to see the police again. I told them that Laura needed her seizure medicine. She didn't have it with her, and she was religious about taking it. She wouldn't not come home." The officer insists to Tim Miller that his daughter has simply run off and will probably be home any day now, before stating that Laura knows the medication she needs and almost certainly had a means to get it outside of the prescription that she had. I'm sorry, but that's just shoddy, lazy police work to think that a 16-year-old in 1984 is going to get hard-to-come-by seizure medication off the streets. It really speaks to how officers in League City viewed these cases of missing young girls and women. And the Millers are very quick to start feeling the same way, especially as later that afternoon, Tim Miller gets some information that sends him reeling. As he learns from acquaintances about the disappearance of Heidi Villarreal Fay from the very same convenience store payphone that Laura went missing from. Then Tim Miller learned that Heidi's remains had been discovered that previous April. On April 4th, 1984, a family was in their backyard when their dog emerged from the woods behind their house, carrying something in its mouth. Now, initially, the family assumed the dog was carrying a ball. However, they quickly realized this wasn't the case and that the animal was, in fact, carrying a human skull in its mouth. They contact the police, who arrive and begin searching this area, which borders Calder Drive. Calder Drive is another name along with League City that you're going to want to remember, as this area plays heavily into the next spate of disappearances and killings that are going to occur. Police eventually make their way over to a field that is roughly 300 yards from the house where the dog brought the human skull to. It is a humble oil field. It's pretty barren except for a single well. This area is going to become known as Calder Field. Searching the field, the police find a skeleton lying on its back beneath a tree, with the clothing and jewelry that had been on the skeleton placed nearby. The coroner eventually is able to identify the remains as belonging to Heidi Villarreal Fye, although he is unable to give a definitive cause of death. The fact that the skeleton has broken ribs leads him and many within law enforcement to speculate that Heidi may have been beaten to death. The police were able to learn that although a worker had driven through the service road onto Calder Field once a week in the period of time since Heidi had gone missing, he had neither seen nor noticed anything out of the ordinary, be it a person on the property or Heidi's corpse. Now, according to Tim Miller, when he spoke to police about Heidi's disappearance and eventual murder, the officer he spoke to basically dismissed any possibility that Laura and Heidi's disappearances could be connected in any way, basically insinuating that because Heidi worked as a cocktail waitress and a DJ, she had placed herself into situations that led to her demise. This is a fairly routine mindset of police officers during this period of time when a young woman goes missing and is later found to have been murdered, that they had somehow done something to put themselves into the position where they were able to be targeted and murdered. Now, according to Tim Miller, he demanded to know from the police where exactly Heidi's body had been discovered. However, the police refused to give this information to him. Quote, he said that the field was private property and all fenced in, and he told me not to bother Heidi's family. He kept insisting that Laura was a runaway and she'd be back home. Tim Miller has since said that over the next 17 months, his days were filled with dread and apprehension as he waited for word of his daughter's fate. He knew in his heart that Laura had not run away, but the police seemed disinterested in investigating her disappearance. Now, there's some contradiction as to when Laura's body's actually discovered. Some sources state that she's found on February 2nd, others that she is found on February 3rd, 1986. In either case, a group of four boys riding on dirt bikes had made their way onto the Calder Road oil field, and while they're riding around, they smell what they knew to be something decomposing. They go to investigate it and find the decomposing body of Laura Lynn Miller. They contact the police, who quickly converge on the area. And in addition to Laura's body, they find a set of human bones sticking out of the soil nearby. Roughly 200 yards away from where Heidi Fye's body had been discovered, the Millers end up going out to the site where Laura's body is found, only to discover that it is not as the police had said it was. There was no fenced off areas on Calder Road, and they believe that the police, while not intentionally, were complicit in their daughter's murder, as well as the murder of the other body that had been found nearby, and that the police did not really look into the disappearance of Laura Miller and had not disclosed to the Millers the location where Heidi had been discovered 11 months prior to their own daughter's disappearance. Now, the other body that was discovered on the day Laura's was found is going to remain unidentified for decades. When she is identified in April of 2019 via DNA as 30-year-old Audrey Lee Cook. Now, according to multiple sources, Cook was last seen in late December of 1985. She was a mother of two who had worked as an auto mechanic for 7 years, but eventually she ends up getting involved in the drug trade. Some sources state that her body was buried, others that she was not buried but had simply been hidden from view. However, the majority of these sources do in fact state that Cook's body was at least partially buried when it was discovered. Some theories postulate that Cook, because of her connections to the drug world, may have been murdered by somebody inside of that world for a variety of reasons. However, it is highly unlikely that she would be placed at this area on Calder Road, so close to where one victim had been found and where Laura's body would be found on the same day as Audrey's, especially given the fact that Laura's body had been lying there for a period of months by the time that Audrey went missing and is presumed to have been put in the field. It's more likely than not the three of them were victims of the same individual or individuals. However, there are some differences in these crimes. Laura and Heidi both disappeared from the exact same convenience store payphone in 11 months of one another. And Heidi is believed to have been beaten to death. However, no cause of death for Laura has ever been given. Whereas Audrey is believed to have been shot to death as a small caliber bullet wound was discovered at the base of her spine. Calder Field, though, is not done giving up its secrets in this story, however, and we are going to cover that in depth during the next episode of this series. So we're going to leave it here. It's February of 1986. Two more bodies have been discovered in the Caldor oil field, one of which is able to be identified as belonging to 16-year-old Laura Lynn Miller. The community is shaken once again, as it had been during the 1970s when the series of killings had been centered around Galveston. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Until next time, stay morbid.